I'm David Roberts, student induction graduate course, Dr. Baco class, standing due to interview Dr. Thomas J. Flanagan, 165 Ashby Street, Northeast, Northwest. Time, 4 o'clock, June 28th, 1973. The actual interview will now take place.
I am Thomas Jefferson Flanagan, 165 Astor Street, Northwest, and an alumnus of Atlanta University of the class of 1926, I believe.
There you go. Dr. Flanagan, when were you born?
About April 7, 1896.
Where were you born?
At Lumpkin, Georgia, a little town in southwest Georgia, Stewart County.
Could you tell me a little about your early experience in Stewart County?
I was reared on a farm, and it was 9 miles from town. And I remember when I was 3 years old, I distinctly remember that because my older sister stood us up by our farmhouse door and had a nail notching our height. And she told me that I was 3 years old, and I never forgot it.
Well, then, tell me a little about your family.
Well, we had a large family. I think there were 9 of us. 7 boys and 2 girls. And we thrived out there on a farm. We had a big time. We had a plenty of space. We had about 300 acres of land. And our neighbors were our cousins, with a few exceptions. And we grew up like common rural children. I entered the Bluff Spring Elementary School when I was 6 years old. It was 3 miles from our farm. And we walked 3 miles going and 3 miles coming back. And school wasn't particularly graded. We had about 6 months schooling a year. And we had to use books. We didn't have any books much. We had to share the books. And large classes of school children in the rurals. And about 10 persons in a class, and about 3 books to be passed up and down that class as the recitations proceeded.
When do you remember examples of discrimination in Lumpkin County?
Well, I remembered it was a long time before I experienced any discrimination. Of course, we had colored schools and white schools. My father ran a blacksmith shop. Am I talking?
Yes.
My father ran a blacksmith shop. Most of his customers were white. And I had a neighbor with whom I liked to play, and he liked to play with me. He afterwards became a doctor. And we used to go together up the same road to our schools. And when we got to those big canyons down there known as the Providence Canyons, we divided. And we played baseball along the road like school children would do and get to school late. And finally, we liked to play so well, he asked his mother one day why he couldn't attend school with me. And his mother gave him the first introduction, I guess, of the race question. She told him why he had to go to Providence School and I had to go to Bluff Springs. We parted. We didn't meet anymore until we turned out in the afternoon, and we sometimes joined each other and sometimes we didn't. But she told him, evidently, that I was colored and he was white. After she differentiated our racial status, he didn't care to play with me much after that. I don't know what else she put on as a collateral to reemphasize that we should be divided, but wherever it did, it worked. Then I didn't know there was any difference in the races, because on my grandfather's farm, most of those colored boys, end quote, were blondes and brunettes, and they had blue eyes and straight hair, and the colored boys was about white as the white boys, and that some of them were.
That must have been mixing of the race down there.
Yeah. Yes, it was. Very much. And so those boys, we got along all right, though. But the colored boys thought they had an advantage because they had short hair and didn't have to comb it much. And those other boys who were light-skinned and had straight hair had trouble with their hair. They had to cut it oftener, and it was in their way playing baseball. And so the colored fellas got an air of superiority in that they didn't have to worry with so much hair. Hence, when I first heard flatly of the race question, two young boys used to come to my father's shop, Oscar Weaver and Eugene Weaver. They were brothers. And they both had high, hot tempers. And one day, a boy whose father was white was down there with them climbing a tree. And this white boy asked Oscar like this, and I quote, "Ain't y'all Ben Weaver's boys?" And he said, so Oscar asked him, say, "Aren't you John House's boy?" He said, "Well, people call my father Mr. House." He said, "Well, you call my father Mr. Weaver." And they got up quite a little scrap out there, and my father went to settle it. And they didn't fight, but Oscar contended that other boy should call his pa Mr. And they each was out there fussing over the titles.
How was it settled?
My father broke it up some way. I don't know. My father was quite a diplomat because he had his customers. He didn't want a conflict at his ranks of clients. So that was, I heard of the race question then. That day I heard of it more emphatically. And I remember my sister found a whip in the road, a wagon whip. She brought it to our house. And my mother looked at the whip, and my father knew everybody's whips and lap robes and things that came to the shops. So he suggested that that was a Mr. X's whip. So my mother sent word up there and told him that they had found a whip. So the next day, some great boys with great large wide brim hats came down there in a wagon, and they told my mother, they didn't say good morning. He just called and told us, they bring that whip out of there. I remember that. And she threw the whip out at them, threw it out there. So they had on checkered shirts and big hats, and they tried to talk like men, change their voices. And I said, they didn't thank you for the whip. She said, no, they didn't thank me. And I said, they called you Aunt Fanny. She said, yes. I said, are you kin to them? She said, no. So that's just the way those boys address colored ladies. And then she explained to me that they were white boys. I said, white boys, I said, what's that make? Don't white boys have manners like other boys? Then she explained to me things that I have been relearning ever since. And you can read between the lines what she told me. But I got an impression there that white boys didn't have any manners. And I was glad I wasn't white so I could have manners. And I was glad. And then around the shop, I had heard white boys use bad words. And colored boys didn't use bad words because their parents would whip them, or if any grown person was around the shop and heard them, he would whip them or relate to their parents what they had done. Then I began to feel proud again that I was colored. And so I could use, I thought that all white folks use bad words. And I kept that opinion for a long time until I learned to differentiate on a higher level.
What would you say relationship in Lumpkin County was between black and white?
It was good. That's Stewart County.
Stewart County.
Yeah, Lumpkin County is up in North Georgia. And that's one of the ironies of Georgia. Now, Lumpkin County, Dahlonega, is the capital. And Dawson County, Dawsonville, and Dawson, Georgia, is in Terrell County, and so forth and so on. Someday that might be rectified. But we had excellent racial conditions in that county. We had some lynchings down there.
Would you tell them about the lynching? What caused the lynching?
I was a small lad. And a colored man. We use the term black, but, and I do not resent the use of it. I use it in the classics. I use it. In my writings, I use black. But I was brought up on a word called colored. Now,
what year, if you can recall, what year was this?
That was about 1916. Near our plantation on the road to Cuthbert, a colored man shot the sheriff. He was a good man and supposed to have been a good citizen. But in some altercation, this colored fella shot him.
You don't know what it was about, the reason he shot him?
I do not. I was a small lad. Right. I didn't know it until after several weeks afterwards. But they came up there hunting that colored man. They scoured the county for him with dogs. And finally, my recollection, if it serves me right, he came up there and went in a fodder loft. Modern day students might not know what a fodder loft is, but it was that second story or the second unit of a corn crib where you threw the fodder in up over the corn. But he crawled up in there and hid himself. And a little colored boy about 6 years old saw him. And so in a course of a few hours, the link just came up. They're hunting this man. He asked all the children, had they seen a man come through there? All the little children, they were acquainted with racial conditions, because some of them was older than I was. And they told him, no, we haven't seen anybody. And there's one little boy standing on the ground about 3 years old. He said something. And the other boys tried to drown him out, but the gang came there and made them let him talk. He said, a colored man came by here, and he went up in that fodder loft and pointed. So they went up there and got this colored man out. And that's been a long time. And if my memory serves me right, they lynched him. That was the first lynching that I had heard of. Another one was a citizen a colored citizen who owned land, was leased some timber to some sawmill people, perhaps turpentine factors, and they cut. No, somebody else leased the timber, and when they cut the timber, they kept cutting across the line where this colored man owned. And this colored man was nearly white, too, and so he went down there and talked some big talk, and the man shot him, left him down the field. And that happened about 6 miles from my home. And feelings ran high right immediately after these lynchings, but was no clash between the races. There was no part on the part of the Negroes to resent it in any way other than talk about it. It blew over.
What year did you come to Atlanta?
I came to Atlanta the first time I was about 18 years old to work for the Atlanta Independent. I believe I was 16 to work for the Atlanta Independent, a newspaper edited by Ben Davis. And I worked as city editor and to go around and get up ads.
Could you tell me something about Mr. Davis?
Mr. Davis was an old retired, he was a former school teacher. And he had attended Atlanta University. He was a classmate of Henry Lincoln Johnson, who was afterwards appointed recorder of deeds and an eminent colored lawyer, and John Wesley Davidson, who founded Fort Valley State College. At that time, it was the Fort Valley High and Industrial School. And Thomas H. Malone, the poet. Tom Malone was one of his classmates. He didn't take graduate work. He went out to teach rural schools and so forth. And he taught in my county. He taught my mother and father. And in that wise, I got acquainted with him. And when I became a college student, he sent for me to come up here, up to Atlanta, and work for his Atlanta Independent.
Wasn't that some kind of controversy around Ben Davis?
Well, yes, he was always in a controversy about something. He was iconoclastic, and quick temper, and quick to speak, and he didn't succeed so well teaching school in small communities, and he was a Republican, and he was appointed by I believe it was McKinley, as a liquor gauger, and he was stationed at Athens, Georgia, and I do not recall the details, but I think there was some liquor came up missing, and he was indicted for it. But he was never tried. They wore the indictment, didn't wear it out, but they wore it so low until somewhere down the line, the Internal Revenue, what we call today the customs, finally forgave him. And he was glad to get his citizenship back. I remember that distinctly.
Was he ever associated, supposed to have been associated with the Communist Party?
The Communist Party?
Yes.
No, he was a Republican from the ground up. That was his son joined the Communist Party.
What was his name?
B.J. Davis, Jr.
What year did you go to? What college did you go to?
I went to Atlanta University. I graduated from Atlanta University.
You was at Atlanta University before that? When it was an undergrad college?
Yeah, undergrad.
What was student life like?
Atlanta University, it was a great life. It was the first time that we fellas tasted the pure air of freedom. Atlanta University was founded by Edmund Asa Ware from Brentham, Massachusetts. Mr. Ware was from Yale. And Bumstead and Chase, those were his buddies, who came down from Yale. So Atlanta University literally came out of Yale. And the state of Georgia had no facilities for college training for Negroes. And they gave Atlanta University $25,000 a year to sort of subsidize and to keep the heat off the state for its segregational policy. But the visitors, the Board of Visitors, I was told this by one of my professors at Atlanta University, Dr. Edgar H. Webster. He'd like to reminisce over the early years. He told us that the visitors came over there and caught the colored students eating in the same dining hall with the white students. Those white students were the children of the professors of Atlanta University. Our teachers taught their children right along with the colored people. And so they made their report to the board, to the state, that the colored children and the white children were over there eating together. And so they called our president on the carpet. I think he said it was Mr. Francis who was acting president. I think President Ware had died. And he told them that they couldn't any longer give them that $25,000 until the white students stopped eating with the colored. And Mr. Webster told us that Mr. Chase, or Francis, told him, "You can take your $25,000. Said Christ ate with his disciples. We eat with our students. That's our privilege. You can take your $25,000, but you can't take our privilege." And we lost that $25,000. Subsequently, they set up a conscience love shelter. They set up the Georgia State Industrial College at Savannah for colored youth. That was on the math head for colored youth. And Richard Robert Wright, the hero of the statement later in former years when General O.O. Howard came to Atlanta University to visit him. And he asked the student body, what shall I tell the students when I go back to Howard? And Richard R. Wright, Sr., rose and told him, tell him we arise. And General Howard thought a lot of that statement.
Can you tell me a little bit about Mr. Wright? Is he the Wright from Carterville, Georgia?
That's right.
Can you tell us about that?
He was from Dalton, Georgia. That's the same area. This is the same Richard R. Wright, Sr. He was the father of Bishop Richard R. Wright, Jr. But he's the one that said, we are rising. And the poet John Greenleaf Whittier up in Massachusetts got that statement, and he wrote a poem, We Are Rising. And I think it was subsequently set to music. But that's where that topic was born. Atlanta University was a historic place, and still is. It had such students as George A. Towns and James Weldon Johnson, Walter White, and some others that I do not, Tom Malone, the poet, and some others that I do not recall. It was an illustrious, it has an illustrious tradition.
When you came, you were here in Atlanta in 1906 when the riot occurred.
I was not.
You were absent from the city.
Yeah, I wasn't here then. I was a boy on the farm, but I remember hearing about it.
How were blacks treated in the courts when you came to Atlanta?
Somewhat like they're treated now. We didn't have but one colored lawyer here, and he didn't practice before the bar at that time. That was Peyton A. Allen, from a school teacher from Noonan, Georgia. He passed the bar and practiced law, but principally, he had paperwork.
Were the black treated with courtesy in the court?
No.
Can you give me examples of any cases that you know?
Well, I remember now, this hasn't been long ago. They would hustle the black prisoners like animals in the courtroom with no respect and courtesy for them. And at the bar, there was a certain judge came here visiting. He was holding court and in the Fulton County Courthouse. And there was one colored witness said to the white counsel, yeah, no. Beg pardon? No. This judge said, listen, Negro, you say yes, sir, and no, sir, to this white counsel. I thought that was mighty raw and grounds for a new trial if somebody would go to that extent. But Negroes seldom saw new trials on such grounds.
What hospital facilities were available for blacks when you came to Atlanta?
Grady.
Only one?
Only one. And it was overcrowded, understaffed, and underfed.
How did they treat
blacks? About like they treated civilians. Second rate, second class. Yeah. They had second class facilities.
Were you here before Grady was established?
No.
It was here when you...
Yeah, and I came here. It was formerly the old Atlanta Medical College.
Did you ever have any contact with Henry McNeil Turner?
I saw Bishop Turner one time. I saw him twice. I was here in Atlanta, and a minister brought me here as a boy, and Bishop Turner was quite famous, and he figured that I wanted somewhere in my life to remember seeing him. So he took me to his home at Betty Young Street. And there I saw a little short man stretched out on a cot. And he told me that was Bishop Turner. I saw him afterwards when I was about 16 years old. My father used to take me around to Methodist meetings, and I saw Bishop Turner in Buena Vista, Georgia. He was old then and decrepit and very unkempt. He'd spit anywhere, and his clothing were unpressed. And he looked to me that he was about 80 odd years, up in 80. But he remembered vividly having read some of the little rhymes and doggerels that I had been sending to Ben Davis's paper. He had a good mind and a good memory. And he told me then that I ought to try to write some sacred music. Instead of writing dialect and folklore, he said, you ought to say the church needs somebody to write its hymns. And from that day, I started to write hymns for all churches.
You remember when Washington High was established?
I remember when Washington High was established.
Why was it located on Hunter Street when the majority of the blacks lived in the Fort Ward?
Well, that's debatable. I don't know. I've often thought most of the blacks lived over there. But the west side was coming, this side of town, and I guess it was a matter of the fulfillment of prophecy that it should be on this side, because most all of the colored people now are on this side of town. And I guess it was presumed that we wouldn't have but one high school. But we have another over there called David T. Howard on Houston Street, right there near the site of old Marsh Brown College. So they wrote better than they knew when they started high school education on the west side of town.
Do you remember any mayors here in Atlanta who had an adverse effect on the blacks here?
I remember one, P.C. Turnell, to his ashes. Mayor I.N. Ragsdale. At that time, when the shift was being made on the west side, and the whites were getting to the urban centers, he would crowd the colored children up in schools and didn't have facilities for black students and black as they should have. And, for instance, Walker Street School, all the white folks moved away from around Walker Street, there this side of the terminal station. And that school stayed shut up for the rats and the lizards for a long time. And colored children were walking from there over to right around there, living in the same houses the white folks lived in. They were walking up from there to Royce Street and other places that would accommodate black children.
Do you remember what year that was?
No, I do not. Yeah.
There were many governors here whose attitude was bad towards blacks.
I couldn't say whether their attitude was bad, or I would say that their environment, they tried to create a bad environment. I know a man whom the Negroes thought a lot of, that toured the country and got elected governor of the state on the race question. I knew two of them that did it. And one, Governor Hoke Smith, I was a boy in my teens, he toured the state on a platform to disfranchise the Negro.
Do you remember when it was 1903 when they disfranchised the blacks here? Or when Georgia added to their constitution?
It was 1903 or 4. I think it was 1905. That's what I've been saying.
Okay.
He ran on that platform. And when he was elected governor, among the first messages that he sent to the General Assembly, one, to disfranchise the Negro. And that kept him away from the polls.
What about Talmadge? You remember anything about him?
I remember Eugene Talmadge. I knew him personally. He was one of these politicians whose antagonisms elevated him to the governorship. I don't think he ever went to the Senate. He didn't, but his son went there. Yeah, he ran on a race question.
In other words, this was the Klan's out in Unit
11? I don't remember seeing them, but they were here when I came.
Did you ever see them down in your hometown?
No. Never seen them.
You remember anything about Booker T. Washington?
I saw Booker Washington once. I went to Tuskegee Institute to visit a cousin of mine who was a student there, and I wanted to see Booker Washington. And I was eager to go up to the campus to see him. I saw him one morning when Major Morton came in there on a train. Major Morton afterwards became president when Booker Washington died. Robert Russell Morton, he came from Hampton. And Booker Washington was not an impressive man so much to see, but he was a stalwart statesman and whose philosophies I share. He was a short man, slightly bow-legged, had gray eyes, stubble hair, and it was kind of reddish, and he was kind of a red man.
When Theodore Roosevelt was elected in 1901, I think, did you have the same hope that the rest of the blacks had that this was a new day for blacks? And how did this work out?
Well, it was a new day for blacks. And I thought a lot of Teddy Roosevelt. I never did see him. But the first time I heard of Mr. Roosevelt was, he was a lieutenant colonel in the Spanish-American War. And the first time I heard anything about him was, he fired those black soldiers. He gave them, I think, dishonorable discharge in that Brownsville episode. Brownsville, Texas. The whole outfit. Now, he was not a Southern politician, and I don't know whose instance that he did that, but it was never forgotten, and I doubt whether he will ever be forgiven.
Did blacks couldn't vote here in the Democratic primary? You recall that?
I recall that. They couldn't vote here in the Democratic primary.
1948, when they started voting.
Right.
Who did they vote for when they voted?
They voted for Governor William Y. Atkinson of Noonan. He was the favorite candidate. Now, I wasn't taking part in politics. I was still in my teens. But Governor Atkinson, as I can recall, was a favorite among the Negroes.
Remember anything about William E. Du Bois?
I knew Dr. Du Bois. I was in his classes and doing graduate work at Atlanta University. Dr. Du Bois felt that sauce for the goose was sauce for the gander. He and Booker Washington were at variance as to the principles of education. The policies, I think the principles were the same, but Dr. Du Bois felt that a Negro should have the same kind of education that a white man should have, as much. Booker Washington's theory was industrial education, and I think that was one of his successes in the founding of Tuskegee Institute, because he readily found capital when he would take them down there and see those colored boys making harness and collars and pads and plowshares and wagons and building buggies and laying bricks and working with their hands. He came here to Atlanta in 1895. And made that famous Atlanta speech, "Let your bucket down where you are." Well, that evoked quite a consternation. They felt that they had been letting their buckets down where they were, and those buckets brought up toad frogs and wiggletails. Negro was disgusted with any kind of policy leaning toward letting his bucket down where he was, because he had done that.
And he hadn't gotten the results.
He didn't get any results.
What kind of person was Dr. Du Bois, as you remember?
He was a party statesman. He was a mulatto Negro, and he had the bearing of a scholar. He was kind of eccentric and selfish. I remember distinctly he had a high opinion of himself, and in that he was out of the reach of the masses whom he sought to uplift.
Wonder why you think he had this high opinion of himself?
Because he had attended, he was born in the state of Massachusetts. He had attended open schools, I mean schools with white folks and all. He didn't know anything about segregation. He didn't know anything about the climate in which he was working. And he strove to carry forward just like he started. He believed, and he wrote several books. One of them I remember distinctly, in which he told his philosophies. Dr. Du Bois was not a favorite, generally, in the South among the white or the colored. But as time grew on, we all learned to admire Dr. Du Bois, because he founded the NAACP along with two or three other liberal white men. And that NAACP finally brought about a philosophy of equality among the races.
Dr. Flynn, that's about all I have. If you're tired or you want to say anything else, please feel free to do so.
I am happy to talk with this student. He represents the carrying on of this new day in which we are met with some of the problems that we had in early years. And he isn't the first one. I have had white students, graduate students here on interviews. And Dr. Bacot, his advisor, is making a rapid stride toward implementing education, because we would rather see an education walking than to hear it talking at any time. And I bid him Godspeed, and I hope that he will find great results and that these few scattering remarks may be imparted to those who are coming after us. God bless you, and good night.